Okay, welcome back from lunch. I'm going to turn the floor over to Greg Skates and Brian Morris to lead the discussion with regard to related parties.
Thank you, Tom. The topic of related parties was first discussed at the September 2004 meeting of the Standing Advisory Group. Today we'd like to discuss some more topics with respect to related parties and transactions with those parties. First, let's turn to the topic of related parties and fraud risk. The transactions with related parties can provide opportunities for management to perpetrate fraudulent financial reporting. In recent history, numerous enforcement actions brought by the SEC sought a failure to disclose related party transactions. Aside from the potential fraud risk, the board's interim auditing standard on related parties, also referred to as AU Section 334, states that in the absence of evidence to the contrary, transactions with related parties should not be assumed to be outside the ordinary course of business. This brings me to the first series of questions for the Standing Advisory Group to consider. First question, how does the market respond to related party transactions? Are related party transactions perceived as having a higher risk of fraud or error? And second, absence of evidence to the contrary, should transactions with related parties be considered to be in the normal course of business and carry no higher risk of material misstatement than transactions with unrelated parties? Christy Wood.
Thank you. This actually is a topic that CalPERS has a fair amount of experience with. We engage many underperforming companies that, and many of which have related party transactions. And I guess, you know, if I had to send one message to the SAG, it would be that we usually find that where there's smoke, there's fire. And that usually, especially in the post-Enron WorldCom environment, companies that allow, you know, related party transactions when unrelated party transactions are available typically have other judgmental lapses. They have non-independent directors on key committees. You know, they may not always be accounting lapses, but I guess we would find that there are other issues. And so, and many of them, as I said, are not accounting related. But in our observation, I think in our engagement of companies that have governance lapses, we would argue that the presence of related party transactions is usually symptomatic of other, I'm not going to call them ethical lapses, but I would just say sort of judgmental gray areas. And so I do think that these can very often be warning signs of the need to do, I think, take greater care. So I guess I would just want to say from the investor point of view, we look at these with great scrutiny, and especially in the last 5 years. I think, you know, prior to that, it's probably a little bit more prevalent. But in the current environment, I think you really have to wonder what they're thinking. So I guess it's a message of a tone at the top that is concerning. To allow these to continue to exist, when assuming that there are better choices available. And I've never seen a case where there wasn't an equivalent choice. So that's my comment.
Cindy Richardson.
I'd like to echo what Christy said and add a few comments of my own. I think generally speaking, investors view related party transactions as a red flag because it poses a potential for conflict of interest and it creates an agency problem, basically, that can interfere with putting a related party, whether it be a manager, an executive, or a board of director, et cetera's interests, personal interests, ahead of those of share owners. And so that, of course, presents potential for abuse. There's actually a couple of really good studies out there that I'm not sure if you're aware of or not, but there's one on the role of related party transactions and fraudulent reporting that's actually brand new, and it basically looks at 83 SEC enforcement cases where there were related party transactions and fraud, and this includes recent instances of scandals, Refco, Adelphia, Tyco, Rite Aid. So there's a number of very, very high-profile frauds where both elements were present. And the really interesting thing is that the fraud usually occurs at the highest level of the organization. 80% of these cases involve the CEO. 34% of these cases involve the CFO. And a large percentage involved outside parties, and they specifically mention auditors, and brokers. So, again, the potential for abuse is great. There's another interesting study out there about related party transactions in association with corporate governance and firm value, and basically they found a significant correlation between the higher the incident of related party transactions and the higher the dollar amount of those transactions, the weaker the governance generally is in the firm, and generally the lower the stock price. So it has a negative correlation. And in fact, it was found that in both of these studies that related party transactions generally did not benefit shareholders, but in fact could substantially harm them depending upon the specifics of the transaction. And so with respect to treating them as being in the ordinary course, I don't think that would be a good idea, simply because at a minimum, investors deserve full disclosure on these issues, and FAS 57 and SEC Reg SX would accept that if they became viewed as part of the ordinary course of business. And finally, I'd just like to say that the study also, which I thought was very interesting, found that there are types of related party transactions involving fraud that are more frequent. Loans were the most frequent type of related party transaction where there was fraud present, yet relatively few involved direct loans to executives, which is the only type that Sarbanes-Oxley actually prohibits right now. The second most frequent type of related party transaction in these 83 enforcement actions that they looked at, which, by the way, were from as early as they were as recent as 2006 and 1983 is the earliest one that they found. But basically, that involved the purchase of goods and services from related parties where the purchase was either undisclosed, unapproved, or non-existent. And then another frequent type of transaction overall is the sale of goods or services to related parties in which the existence of the relationship was not disclosed and fictitious sales or inappropriate accounting were involved. And financings were another high area of risk. So I just thought that was really interesting sort of background information to sort of launch this discussion. Thanks.
Ted White.
Not to belabor the point, but I would put the same emphasis on as the last two comments. They are very significant issues, and a red flag is a fair term. The only thing I would add is that the normal course of business terminology is something that frankly kind of bothers me. I don't know how a related party transaction could actually be considered sort of normal course of business. By itself, it's something that should deserve specific audit attention. Frankly, if I had my way, I would get rid of that terminology.
Galen Hansen.
Sounds to me like these studies, Cynthia, are pretty interesting. I don't know if there's a way to get a hold of those, but I'd love to read both of those. One thing that happens frequently, and especially with small companies, we frequently get a request that a related party transaction be disclosed as being on the same basis and as that which would occur with a third party. And, of course, there's an auditing standard that says you can't disclose that unless you're willing to audit that assertion. Well, I just wonder whether that might be something that the board might, even though I didn't see it in these materials, that auditing is something to some level that we might consider whether that disclosure is made or not. It seems to me that if you do have transactions occurring with a related party and with non-related parties, that you could make some sorts of conclusions that perhaps should be disclosed. So that's just one thought.
Cynthia Thuber.
Yeah, I think not in all cases, but in many cases, related party transactions certainly indicate that there's a higher risk of misstatement due to fraud. I mean, we saw it in Adelphia and Enron directly related to the fraud. And by the way, the auditors knew about those related party transactions. But I just wanted to point out that in the case of WorldCom, even though there weren't any related party transactions that related directly to the fraud, after the fraud was identified, internal audit found an undisclosed related party transaction related to the chairman of the compensation committee, who was actually leasing a corporate jet from WorldCom for something like $1 a month. And, of course, as you guys know, he approved, the COP committee approved something like $400 million in loans to Bernie Evers. And the way we identified that was in an accounts payable audit. And it was a tip. The accounts payable manager actually came to us and said, hey, look, there, you know, these payments going out to the chairman to reimburse him for some expenses related to this jet, and it looks kind of strange. So, you know, that brings me to the next point, which is I think a good test for related party transactions, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, is to talk to frontline managers, whether they're in the purchasing department or accounts payable, because in all of these companies, and with the frauds as well as related party transactions, there are people who obviously know about this. And while executives at the top of the company and directors may not disclose these related party transactions, there are, I guarantee you, plenty of people in mid-level management on the front line that if we just go in and ask, you know, are waiting for someone to come and talk to them about this.
Bob Gibbers.
I guess a couple things. You know, there are so many stories and so many unpleasant experiences we've all had with related party transactions that have, you know, are somehow nefarious, and yet in business there are so many almost unavoidable related party transactions. You've got one client that does a lot of its work through joint ventures. They happen to make a product, but their natural resources that are their raw material. They set up ventures in different geographies with a partner that has the raw materials. They produce the, you know, the interim goods or whatever. Those are related party transactions, and their co-ventures are related parties by definition because they have joint investments. So some of what has to happen is truly in the ordinary course. But number two up there, you know, is completely turned around. If there's a related party involved, I mean, there's no way you can assume it's in the normal course of business, and there's no way you can assume it carries no higher risk. I mean, almost by definition, it's just the opposite. And so, you know, that first clause is important, absent of evidence to the contrary. That's the whole point. You know, you've got to get to the bottom of it and decide whether or not it's legitimate or not. I do think the latest thinking, though, around this is in the yet-to-be-completed project of the IAASB, and I don't know if you recall, but they had originally had an exposure draft and had a tremendous wealth of comments, some of which caused them, I think, John, to re-expose. And some of the things that were on the table at that time, this is just last year, is recent scandals where frauds had occurred. And to try and align a new related party standard in the audit space with the audit risk model framework. In other words, to get more connectivity there. So I'm not suggesting that the board or the staff, adopt that wholesale. I'm just saying, in terms of current thinking, that body of commentary and the process that's, I think, about to close in a few weeks with the next round of comment letters were probably some of the best information available.
Any other comments on this series of questions? Yes, Chuck Noski.
Interestingly enough, with some of my board work, as the new proxy rules are coming, have come out requiring more disclosure about related party transaction policies, a lot of companies are re-looking at their policies and making judgments about what it is they're going to disclose, which is broader and deeper than we've seen before. So we've done a lot of work on some of my boards in looking what companies are saying, and one of the interesting things we've noticed is that some companies, in describing the management and the board's philosophy about related party transactions, some will require that a related party transaction be on economical terms that are better than they get with a third party. Some will talk about being as good as or approximate, or some will be silent. And so I think this next round of proxy disclosure is going to be very revealing in terms of, if you will, the tone at the top, at the board and at the senior management level, about how they think about related party transactions. So there's going to be a bit more transparency out there. I don't think we should kid ourselves that it's going to be terrific, but I think there'll be a great deal more transparency. And so looking at these new related party transaction policies, which a lot of companies are revamping right now and spending a lot of time with their law firms on, I think is going to be a rich area for somebody to do some analysis about, and probably can inform auditors about their risk assessment.
Arnie Hanisch.
Greg, I've got maybe more of a question than a statement. Is the definition here is it extended to related parties from an operational and business perspective that would involve intercompany transactions with entities that are wholly owned subsidiaries, or is it because I was looking and I was reading ahead, in preparation for today, and it talks about known related party transactions on page 6, arrangements for audits of intercompany account balances. So I mean, is it that broad as far as what we're discussing here, that broad of a definition? Or, as I think Bob was suggesting, because there are normal intercompany transactions or intercompany activities with subsidiaries that are in the normal course of business, to your point up there. Or is this really more related to related parties? Is the intent of this discussion to limit it to related party transactions where there's individuals within the company or board members that may have financial interests in entities that are doing business with our companies?
Well, it's not limited with your it's a broader definition than what you indicated earlier, Arnie. We intend for it to be broader, and that's what the definition is, because the auditor has to determine who are the related parties, and then make a determination then at that time what risks are associated with those related parties.
Well, with that, then I would say, difference to what I think somebody said earlier, there are intercompany transactions that can be in the normal course of business as part of just an overall intercompany relationship with a wholly owned subsidiary, where you have normal transfer pricing and other things that takes place. I think somebody had suggested that it was not in the normal course, I thought.
Any other comments on those first couple of questions before we move ahead? Okay, Brian Morris will introduce the next series of questions for us.
Let's turn to our next topic on understanding the company's related party relationships. The board's interim standard, AU Section 334, outlines audit procedures for understanding a company's related party relationships and also provides an illustrative list of procedures the auditor might perform to identify material transactions with parties known to be related and to identify material transactions that may be indicative of the existence of previously undisclosed relationships. It's really a mouthful. This brings us to our next question, which is, Should the auditor perform procedures for understanding and identifying a company's related party relationships in every audit, regardless of the assessed level of risk? And if so, what should those procedures be? Joe Carcello?
In the document that you sent out to us, you mentioned that what is often done, unless practice has changed an awful lot from when I was in practice, which probably has, but I don't think it's changed here. Essentially what was done is you get a list, if you were lucky, from someone ahead of you on the engagement team and say, here are potential related parties. And that was pretty much it. And it was not what I would call a very structured process to search for related parties. It was very much ad hoc. And I think given the risk surrounding related party transactions and the fraud situations, and bluntly, given the growth today of electronic tools to both access the GL 100% and access public database records on private companies and potential businesses that the company may have arrangements with, for firms to not be doing more now doesn't seem very defensible to me. And so I think the board should think seriously about this particular issue in providing more structure and guidance to the firms in terms of what's expected of them in trying to identify related party transactions. Because let's be blunt about it. If there's a massive fraud, and I'm the CEO, and I've created a shell private company to perpetrate the fraud, I'm not going to tell you about it. And so that's really the risk.
I think Howard was actually first on that, so Howard Johnson.
Yeah, I think there ought to be some scrutiny of this area every audit. I think there's a lot you can look at from what's going on within the company as far as looking at this area as some independent function like, say, internal audit or legal or loss prevention or somebody else like that. Taking a look for at related party type transactions, has internal audit audited the sourcing process lately? What were the findings? What happens with sole source agreements? Do they have, you know, a process for those type of exceptions where you wouldn't go out and bid? And are those really being adhered to? I think there's a lot of inquiry you can make as to what the company itself is doing to look at this area. If you don't get many good answers, or people aren't looking at it, or it's not on somebody's plan or independently checked, I would be highly skeptical of what's going on. So I think besides just before jumping into and doing some more of the perfunctory stuff, just a lot of inquiry and observation and reading whatever has been published on this area within the company could be helpful.
Damon Silvers?
This is obviously an area where both there's the transactions themselves should be sort of given heightened scrutiny in light of the possibility that there are going to be some sort of material omission or failure to disclose or mischaracterization is going on. There's every incentive on the part of many people to do that in these types of transactions. But even more importantly, because they are a potential roadmap to things that are much more serious that even than the transaction itself. And I'll just take a rather well-worn example of this, which is that there was a related party transaction aspect to the special purpose entities at Enron. That aspect of those entities was not the beginning or end of the problem. But once you understood what the related party transaction was, then clearly anyone with half a brain could figure out that there are now 20 more questions you need to ask and ask very quickly about a whole range of matters that turned out to be the keys to the overall fraud as a whole. So that's the backdrop against which the importance here I think that what you have proposed in ISA 550 is a very good list of specific requirements that need to be gone through. And I would focus on one in particular, which is the requirement to look at minutes of meetings of shareholders and of those charged with governance. I assume that that's a catch-all category that includes the board. My own experience in identifying dealing with improper behavior is that board minutes are critical. Most of the worst stuff is signposted there someplace, right? And you have to be reading them with an eye toward, you know, what are these minutes telling you as an auditor about what transactions are going on with related parties, and of course, as is usually the case, the things they're trying to hide are, you know, it's like three words someplace, or you know, and not just the full board, by the way, but the committee minutes. And I would hope that this line here in this briefing document would be a little more fully threshed out in the actual document. I think that specifically directing auditors to review those documents, board minutes, board committee minutes, to the extent there may be, if you're talking about, say, a financial institution, there are committees that review and approve transactions generally, looking at those sorts of minutes as well. That's the critical place to be. And so I would just sort of highlight that as one aspect of why I think this is a very good list.
John Kellis.
Thank you. I think your question sort of conflates understanding and identifying, and I think understanding is the key to this, and that in any audit which directs itself to those areas of greatest risk and importance, you must understand what you're looking at and understand the business and its business and commercial relationships. When we did the initial exposure draft, we got a lot of pushback on the second aspect of that, the straight identifying, which is, for the reasons already mentioned, it is going to be extremely difficult to identify related party relationships and transactions that people wish to conceal from the auditor. It is simply too difficult. And I think that's why the combination of understanding commercial relationships and, when it comes to identification, being alert to the possibilities of related party transactions. So when you are reading the minutes or when you're dealing with any transaction at all, is that the possibility of related party relationship here that might affect the transaction, particularly if its commercial rationale doesn't quite seem right. But it would probably be an unjustified burden to place some sort of specific obligation on the auditor to identify related party transactions in all circumstances.
Sam Renzler.
I agree with John Kellis. I think there is incumbent on an auditor to do some work around the understanding of related party relationships. I don't know how you can not, in order to assess the level of risk, you have to be able to assess, you have to have an understanding of the transactions themselves. So I think just a risk assessment process would require you to look at related party transactions and then to at least obtain an understanding around the company's controls. But I don't think because there's related party transactions, you immediately go to forensic auditing in an attempt to find unidentified related party transactions. You might, but there's, I think, other risk factors that come into play before you start searching the archives of the company record system in the United States looking for related party transactions.
Joe Carcillo.
A couple of points. One point, it's a little bit off this question, but I think relevant, that was mentioned in the Henry et al. Briefing paper or the Horizons paper that you mentioned as background, is that when there are related party transactions, particularly if they involve directors, and those directors have been classified as independent. They're really not independent anymore. At best, they're gray. And so that really, the literature on gray directors is a little bit more nebulous than on insiders, but it's problematic enough to suggest that there needs to be a cycle back on the part of the firm to their evaluation of the control environment. And maybe they're doing that, maybe they're not. I mean, again, that's something you could look at as part of your inspection process. But it would seem to me that you need to think about what that says for the overall control environment, the evaluation of controls on the 404 and so forth. Getting to this issue of identification, I think this is a tricky issue because I certainly am sympathetic to what John and Sam are saying, and to have a full-blown forensic audit, I don't think anybody's advocating that. On the other hand, if the only responsibility is to evaluate those related party transactions that you are aware of or that management makes you aware of, again, the ones that are going to be the most problematic are, by definition, going to be the ones that management tries to hide from you. So that makes me nervous to say there's not a responsibility there to identify. The auditor, as we know, has to design the audit to provide reasonable assurance that financial statements are free of material error, whether caused by error or fraud. And so in this case, we're talking about fraud in some cases with related party transactions. I went back and read the briefing paper that you put together for the 2004 meeting on this topic, and you referred to the QCIC report in 2002, and now I quote, "New ideas for identifying difficult to find related party transactions should be investigated and guidance issued." So again, that's the QCIC in 2002, before Sarbanes-Oxley, before you guys were created. It's hard to argue that after the events of the last 5 years that the recommendations in that report are any less germane today than they were 5 years ago. And I do think there are ways to use technology today, short of a full-blown forensic audit, that could help us identify transactions with unusually high profit margins, particularly close to year-end, where cash doesn't change hands. You could identify the company involved in that transaction. You could run it against CompuStat to see if it's a public company. If it's a private company, by definition, unless you know the ownership structure of that private company, there may be more risk involved. And so what I'm suggesting here is not, I don't think, a massive undertaking on the part of firms.
Lynn Turner.
The issues, if you look through some of these where they've been most problematic, Enron, which we're certainly all aware of because of not only the SPEs, but some of the other transactions that they did, Adelphia, Parmalat, Tyson's Food in the recent court case made it very clear that these were issues out there, and it wasn't so much a matter of identification. People knew about them. The auditors knew about the related party transactions. So the identification, which makes sense, you got to go do, and you probably got, you absolutely have to go further than just inquiry. Too much of this is built around inquiry, and so you're going and you're asking a management team that if there's a problem, you're going to go and ask the management team that designed the related party transaction that isn't all above board what it's all about and whether it's kosher. And they aren't going to sit there and tell you, no, we're doing a related party fraud. So inquiry of management doesn't work in this area. That's almost a worthless, you know, waste of time, you know. It's doing other things that, like the hedge funds on Enron did, to get an understanding of what was going on with the related party transactions, the SPEs, and why they were there and what was the business purpose behind them. And you don't get that by going and asking management. You don't get that by going and asking Jeff Skilling, why do you have SPEs set up? Or Andy Fastow. They aren't going to tell you. You have yourself got to go through procedures, given whatever the specifics are, to really gain an understanding of what the business purpose is behind it. And if you as an auditor don't get that understanding, you are going to miss the boat. And it wasn't in
Enron and Tyson's and Parmalat, you know, Adelphia, people knew about them. They had been identified. But in those cases, they didn't deal with what's the real business issue and real substance, and then that's the piece that didn't get really reflected in the financials and disclosure. That coupled with the fact that too often related parties tend to be work that's done at the end of the audit as opposed to earlier on with substantive work. It's a footnote disclosure. Yeah, it may be broken out online in the P&L, but that's a breakout. There just isn't enough time, and it's not senior enough. Any standard should say related parties in and of themselves create heightened awareness. And any auditor that doesn't view related parties with heightened awareness and skepticism is starting off on the wrong foot. And so I'd say they need to be heightened awareness in this area. Focus on it. You can inquire of management. Certainly good management will tell you where things are. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is understanding why is it that people are doing the related parties? What's the real business transaction? And inquiry by and in of itself doesn't get you that. And if you can't figure out what's really going on, you're not done, either from a communication perspective with investors or with respect to the audit.
Jeff Stanoff.
I'd like to echo the point that Joe made. I don't think you can understand them without having some idea as to what they are. I think those two things go together. I think the issue here is to what degree. I'm appreciative of the point that John and Sam made. How can you identify all of them? But there has to be some level. I think the proposed International Standard 550, I think, provides a good principle basis. I think the important part here is the second part of your question. What should the procedures be? If the board could define in some way some parameter that didn't head you down the road that John and Sam were concerned about, the auditor having to find every one of them and not ever knowing if they had found every one of them, to something that was reasonable. And something that would give you a basis to understand, because without really identifying at some level what they are, you can't understand what they are. I think that would be a good service, whether that's part of a standard or other guidance. But really, I think the second part of your question gets to the nature of it. I think they have to perform do something to identify them. But how much is really, I think, the difficult question.
Arnie Hanisch.
Yeah, I guess just to go on record, I guess I support most of what's being said here as far as additional procedures that need to, to gain an understanding and identifying companies' related party relationships. But we just clearly need to not let this get out of control to the point where we're suggesting in standards that we would have to undertake some sort of a forensic audit activity. I think that it's when I hear people talk about forensic auditing, we hope it's not in the context that we would clearly go down that path, because I think that would be a mistake. So, but absent that, I think clearly there's a need to for the auditor to understand and perform additional procedures to get satisfied that there's nothing going on with respect to inappropriate related party transactions. I do want to, though, again, come back to the point I made earlier that there needs to be some differentiation, at least in my view, between what I perceive to be related party transactions with businesses that might be owned by a particular individual or board member versus a wholly owned subsidiary of a company where you have normal intercompany transactions in the normal course of business. And it shouldn't be that broad with respect to transactions, because I think you've got other parts of your audit. The other parts of the audit process around the tax auditing that relates to the transfer pricing issues that crop up when you have intercompany and related party transactions that are probably already covered as part of the normal audit.
Cindy Hanisch. Cindy Cooper?
Yeah, I agree with Lynn that the most important thing is to understand the business purpose behind the transactions, and that we can't rely on management inquiry. So it sounds like everybody agrees that there are certain minimum procedures that should be performed on every audit. And so we've talked a lot about principles based today. I would be interested in just hearing from some of my colleagues as to whether or not this is a case with related parties where we should have perhaps a more prescriptive approach in the standards. Ben or anybody?
Happy to go.
You're right.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, my reaction to this question was, and maybe the one before it, you know, when you're beginning to think about assess level of risk, and in my experiences, when you have an organization that has a high level of related party transactions itself identified, your level of risk is up by definition, to Lynn's point. And there are environments where there are businesses that are susceptible to more business transactions among related parties, and your risk assessment should be very different, and you should be amending your procedures in reaction to that. And that's very different than going across and prescribing to go through procedures. If you're going to go and begin to add procedures like that, I think you need to be very careful you're not going to go into some of the discussions we've had between AS2 and AS5, because right away you're going to have a cost-benefit scenario that I do think that was brought up before very, very quickly. You put a procedure there of searching, so forget about that environment, because it's a very different environment, and then you have a normal course of business where you're trying to look at related party transactions at two levels, because I've heard two levels here. One level is one that could have a direct effect on the financial statements, right? A normal course of transaction. And another one, say the example that you used, would be perhaps not a effect on the level of financial statements, but gosh, the board and other people should really know, and investors should know about that transaction, right? And if you look at 57, it has a pretty low level. I haven't read it in a while, but I think it says something like related party transactions need to be disclosed regardless of materiality. All right. So with that standard, the auditor already has a responsibility in assessing the financial statements and the efficacy of the disclosures that all related party transactions, regardless of materiality, disclosed in the financial statements. They are all very principles-based. You started putting rules about how you're going to do that. I would ask you to think about, before you do that, the various nature of the related party transactions, because they're vast. Right? And when you try to start putting individual procedures, you're going to have people going down and spending an awful lot of time in a checklist format for which your ROI on those procedures are not going to be very high. So I would tell you, I'd go back to the principles based, the characteristics of what you're looking for, and when you're in those characteristics, these are the types of procedures that you should be considering and doing.
Damon Silvers.
In response to the prior comment, I think there is this third category I want to emphasize again, which is not the category of transactions that are, in and of themselves material, nor the category of just making sure to identify all related party transactions pursuant to the existing standards, both of which should be done. But what I would like to see in terms of the standard here is that auditors are instructed to engage in an analysis that flows from the question of what is the business purpose of this transaction to the question of what is this transaction telling us about the integrity of the larger financial statements, if anything. Because in many ways, I think what recent experience tells us is that potentially the greatest value of looking closely at related party transactions is not so much the transactions themselves, although they can be very important, but the window that they give you into perhaps other things that are going on that may be much larger in scale. And here I think it's worth being quite specific about instructing the profession as to what the thought process ought to be here, and so that the, regardless of how experienced the auditor may be, there's this little there's a checkbox, and then says, "Have I thought about what the implications are of what I'm finding of each of those may or may be not material items, but are they leading you to other material items that ought to be of concern?" So I just want to make clear that. So that's, I think, a third category that really we ought to have specifically addressed.
No, I'll just add to that, because I think what you're really addressing is the intersection of related party transactions and the SAS 99 standard, right? And the heightened risk of fraud based on the nature and the relationships of the related party transactions. And perhaps that is the place that you would, you know, address your concern, because it really is, you know, a very practical element of the implementation of SAS 99.
The point I'm making is that they are a guidepost to other things, right? That there is some history that suggests that when larger misconduct is involved, or when a larger effort is underway to misrepresent the financial statements, that effort somehow has a related party transaction element to it, right? That there's a place where a little bit of direct self-enrichment goes on, or a place where the insiders are trying to protect themselves against the risks of what they're doing with the company as a whole, and so that if you start pulling that string, right? I mean, I guess what I'm looking for here is language that tells the auditor to start pulling the string, right? And I guess that's a fine term of art there, but you guys know how to translate that into the terms of art.
Okay, well, I think we're going to move on to the next question, which is actually somewhat related to this this topic. So, and I saw Dick Dietrich put his card up, so I'm going to read the question, and then I will you can answer this question and then the previous one as well. Just a little tee up, and that is that the existing standard on related parties goes on to state that an auditor should place emphasis on testing material transactions with parties known to be related to the reporting entity. And the standard further outlines illustrative procedures that the auditor may perform when testing related party transactions. So the question we're going to pose to the SAG is, are there specific types of related party relationships or transactions that pose a higher risk? And if so, should the auditor perform additional procedures? And I guess based on this morning's discussion, that's going to draw some reaction as well. So, Dick Dietrich?
Yeah, since I perceive that there appeared to be a choir of consensus around the idea of related party transactions, I actually want to play devil's advocate for a minute and say, let's suppose that a new standard is developed that says that the auditor is required to identify all related party transactions and understand the business nature of those transactions. I predict that there will be pushback along two lines. The first line will be, this is simply something that's going to drive up audit fees with no commensurate benefits to investors. And the second is that corporations will argue that they are no longer able, or because of this concern, they're less likely to be willing to engage in related party transactions, which some will allege will harm investors because it will force them to engage in less profitable transactions than these related party transactions, which they will assert are somehow more beneficial to their stockholders. So I guess the question I have for others is, are those plausibly logical complaints that have any validity, or are they simply the kinds of criticisms that I perceive will hear with no validity?
Joe Carcello?
I have a response to what you have up here on the board, and that is, are there specific types of related party relationships or transactions that pose a higher risk? It would seem to me that any type of related party transaction, in particular with top management, especially the CEO or the CFO, we know that over 80% of all frauds, at least as documented in SEC enforcement actions, involve the CEO and or the CFO. And so if there's a related party transaction between the company and them, including with their families or other businesses that they control, would seem, that doesn't mean automatically it's fraud, but it would seem to pose higher risk, those types of transactions. I think also a related party transaction that's identified by the auditor that's material that was not disclosed to the auditor by management. I think any time the auditor has even the possible suggestion that there may be lack of top management integrity, that top management is lying to them, I think the risk profile and the level of skepticism needs to go through the roof.